If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Latin American Studies. I'm your host, Elena McGrath. Today I'm here with Donald Stevens to talk about his new book, Mexico in the Time of Cholera. The book takes as its center the 1833 cholera epidemic that devastated the newly independent republic, but Stevens is not primarily concerned with a history of the disease itself. Following archival trails within parish records, novels, and memoirs, Stevens asked how we might be able to measure everyday piety in four Mexican cities during a time of transition and crisis. In so doing, his book offers an intimate window into the life cycle of urban Mexicans from birth and naming practices to death and burial norms. Donald Stevens is an associate professor of history at Drexel University and an assistant editor for the journal The Americas. He is the author of Origins of Instability in Early Republican Mexico and the editor of Based on a True Story, Latin American History at the Movies. He is here with me today to talk about his most recent book, Mexico in the Time of Cholera, published in 2019 by the University of New Mexico Press. Thank you for joining us, Donald. I want to start just with a very basic question, which is, where did this project come from? How did you end up writing a history centered on the cholera epidemic of 1833?
Well, everything for historians is a long story. I think it's important to go back to college, actually. You'll see that maybe later. But I had no intention of being a history major. I thought I knew what history was. And I thought I had AP credits. I thought I'll never have to take another history class. But what I discovered is that history wasn't what it was in high school. Instead, it was a way of asking questions, finding evidence, and evaluating the evidence. So I was raised in a religious household, but I found that that being a historian became my religion. And as a history major, I was required to take a course in something that wasn't Europe or the United States. And I had studied a little Spanish starting in the fifth grade in order to get out of the regular classroom. And so Latin American history kind of made sense. And I enjoyed what I was doing so much that I decided to try graduate school. And of course, we were told that there weren't any jobs and there wouldn't be any jobs. And I figured I'd just keep doing it as long as I could, you know, as long as it was still fun. And so I ended up, I'd read an article by John Coatsworth about railroads and the concentration of land holding in 19th century Mexico. And I thought it was amazing. This was just about the time that Fogel and Engerman's Time on the Cross came out. So quantitative history was quite controversial. And I thought, well, I should I should understand this. And Coatsworth was teaching a graduate class in quantitative history, which I remember taking. I was very skeptical, but it was also an important experience to me because I came out a convert. And since then, I've looked at everything as a question of measurement. How do you know? How can you measure whether something is big or small? So in my first book, I had lots of tables. I had tests of statistical significance, and I got it done in time to be tenured and promoted to associate professor. And then I had to figure out what else to do. And this was around 1991. When cholera returned to the Western Hemisphere for the first time in 100 years. In fact, it was more like 150 years for Mexico. So people were saying, well, this is a 19th century disease. And I thought, I'm a 19th century historian. Why don't I know anything about cholera? I was wandering through my local independent bookstore looking for something to read on my way to Mexico in this trying to figure out what to do next stage when I found Charles Rosenberg's book called The Cholera Years. It was really a fascinating book. It was about the United States, but I learned a lot about cholera, and I thought, well, maybe I could do something like this for Mexico. And that's how it started out, and of course not how it ended up. And it ended up being something not very much like Rosenberg's book at all, but at least that explains why cholera.
That's great. And so, you know, the book does take place during the cholera epidemic, but in one of your guiding concerns, one of your principal concerns is, in fact, a religious question, is how religious were everyday Mexicans and how seriously did they take their religion? So where did those two come together for you?
Well, it's, again, in the first book, I didn't mention, but I was trying to explain the political instability after independence. Rather than trying to explain it, I was trying to evaluate other people's explanations. And in the process, I convinced myself that Mexican society was very different in different places in the country. And I knew from reading other historians that by the end of the 19th century, Mexican historians basically agreed that the Mexican people were fundamentally Catholic, that was an essential identifying characteristic of Mexicans. For conservatives, this was clearly just a matter of faith. That's what they thought. That's because it justified their position. For liberals, it was more a resignation that's the way it was. That they were using that as an explanation about why they hadn't been able to accomplish more. And it seemed to me that they actually had accomplished quite a lot, and that their difficulties were not entirely of their own making, that it wasn't. It's often argued that it was just personalism and individual decisions that govern the politics of this period. And I didn't think that was true, but I wanted to know if there wasn't a way to figure out how religious people were, to measure how religious they were. And that's part of where this comes from, is again, looking at what other people have said or indications of religiosity among the Mexican people. For example, the fact that they give their children lots of names of saints has been used as evidence. But it's also the fact that with a new epidemic in particular, it's a disruption of normal life. And it increases people's fear and makes them maybe think that God is punishing them. And at least I was reading things once I started doing this that said that people did start behaving better. They returned stolen property. They reconciled with spouses that they had been separated from, that sort of thing. And so it seemed to me that if there is a cholera epidemic, that would probably mark a high water mark of religious fervor. And there are a very small number of other historians of cholera who ever mentioned anything like that. But I thought, well, okay, time to see what I can do with this.
Do you find in that a kind of popular religiosity, or is that, to your mind, a sign of things changing?
Well, again, I think it's important to point out that I wasn't dealing with absolute, you know, any sense of really popular, other than the fact that you can clearly distinguish in the parish registers in this period the elite from the common people. But these are all urban people in four different parishes in Mexico. So it's really not a study of popular religiosity. But there is a distance between what the Catholic Church wanted people to be doing and what they wanted to do and what they were doing. So that was part of taking things seriously that other people hadn't taken seriously, like the baby names.
And so you end up with a number of really interesting stories, and there's a real intimacy to the stories you tell, because you're looking at not just how people name their children, but under what conditions they get inscribed in the register, and how they, in some cases, even how they formed relationships with priests or navigated between partners and parents. So how did you approach this kind of intimate source space in writing a history book? And the second part of that question is, do you have a favorite story or episode that you want to talk about?
Well, the first part is harder because I don't know what the answer to that question is. So let me start with the second part, and maybe we can find a way of working ourselves around to being able to answer the first question. Yeah. So the question I can answer is about my favorite stories. Many of my favorite stories are about Concha Lombardo. In fact, I dedicated a whole chapter to her. But of all her stories, my favorite is that when she was 15 years old, she began to be courted by a man named Agustin Franco, who was about 10 years older than she was. And Concha thought he was a bit of a dandy. And but she liked that he was educated and sophisticated. And he would write her letters every day. And a servant in her house would smuggle them in and hide them under her pillow so she would find them in the morning. And she loved this process and eagerly wrote back to him. So every evening when he would come to call on her, which was, of course, in the house under the supervision of her parents, he would take the letters that she had written to him out of his pocket, and he would point out all her errors. Can you imagine? I mean, this is kind of startling. But what I love about this story is her reaction to his pedantry. It was not what I would have expected. She loved it. She was so eager to learn that if she hadn't been eager to learn, she might never have written her memoir, because she certainly wasn't getting much out of the schooling that she received. So the memoir is the source of all of the rest of her wonderful stories about what it was like growing up in the middle of the 19th century in Mexico.
And she doesn't end up marrying him, does she?
Oh, no.
Her adventures do not end with schooling and letter writing.
No. Fortunately, her parents were very lenient with her in comparison with her mother and her grandmother, the way they had been married off. So her parents were giving her room to figure things out for themselves, but they actually figured it out before she did, that this guy was no good for her. He really was not the right man for her. And it wasn't just that he was 10 years older. He was very controlling. And so they took a dislike to him even before she did.
And that's a very interesting sort of difference to what we might expect would happen looking back on a marriage from that time.
Well, there were lots of different ways for marriages to be worked out. And, you know, again, going back to my, you know, the essential quantitative nature of the way that I think this 10-year age gap to me became kind of a benchmark where I actually found that, you know, for the marriage records are very good about reporting the ages and the previous marital status of the brides and grooms who are being married. So you can't always get the level of detail that I could get from Concha Lombardo's stories, but you can look at this gap between the bride and the groom. And, you know, when a girl is 12 years and 2 months old and she's marrying somebody who's three decades older, that's not her idea of what she wants to be doing. So that's a way of measuring what I ended up labeling the difference between patriarchal marriages and companionate. I don't remember what term I used anymore, but that kind of a thing. The fiction in this period is also something that that I really had a lot of fun with. I didn't realize that there were so many novels and short stories written during these years in Mexico. And of course, many of them are romantic stories, but you know, they give you a lot of different ideas about what people thought were realistic stories about romance and marriage. So that was fun.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That is one of my favorite kinds of historical sources. So you mentioned at some point in the book that you got some advice when you were writing this book. And so was it about those sources? Is that...
No, it wasn't about the sources. Well, actually, one bit of advice was that I remember very clearly. I don't know who it was. I wish I could remember. But someone, not a historian, at one of the meetings I attended said that historians really ought to read more fiction. And I said, okay. And so I emailed the person and said, okay, what? This is the period I'm working on. What do you suggest? I never heard back, but I did manage to find a lot of things on my own to read. Now, the best advice I got while I was working on this was absolutely the essential advice. It was after six or seven years, I'd been at this for a while. I'd had a couple of large research grants where, I promised that I was going to finish this up. But I was frustrated because I couldn't figure out how to organize it. And it wasn't making sense together. And I had dinner with a colleague who said to me, she said, being an associate professor means that you can take as long as you want to finish the book. And I realized she was right. And I relaxed and I stopped worrying about the fact that it wasn't finished yet and just kept working on things. And so I probably spent another 20 years after that. I was probably taking her advice too far. Certainly, one acquisition editor believed that that I was never going to finish. She was so frustrated that she actually wrote me a letter saying that there probably wouldn't even be any books anymore by the time I finished. I've never heard of anyone doing
And yet here we are.
There is someone who is famous for her patience and people's acknowledgments. And anyway, so that I had been doing other things. I was chairing the department for a while and editing a journal. The antidote to that advice was that eventually my department chair told me that if I didn't send the manuscript out, he was going to increase my teaching load. And I said, okay, that's a serious threat. it reminded me of something that I had been telling my colleagues when I was the department head. I said, you can't wait until you think it's finished to send it out. Even if they tell you they want a complete manuscript, you can't wait. Because you want to send it out with some obvious flaws, because that's what the reviewers will tell you to fix. And meanwhile, while they're taking their time to read it and doing all of the other things they normally do and writing their report, and all of that time is time that you can spend fixing those flaws. So it was clearly time to finish it up.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you did end up structuring the book, because you follow different kind of moments in a life cycle where people might interact with the church or the record or leave a written trace of their decision making. So how did you come to organize your work this way?
Even in graduate school, I remember I was in fact writing my dissertation, and my committee said, well, just stop messing around with this. Write it in chronological order. And I thought, no, that's not how, I can't do that, because it's not something, this in particular is a moment and it has aspects to it, but you can't write it in chronological order. That doesn't make any sense. So I never really understood that. So we didn't always know that the book would be structured from as a progression from birth to marriage to death. But that was one of the best moments in the whole process when I had that idea. And it made it possible to write transitions between chapters that kept the book moving. I actually began with the burial records. And it was my concern about their accuracy that led me to marriages and baptisms. My friends told me, for example, that people were dying so quickly, that the priests were overwhelmed. They couldn't keep up, so they shouldn't believe the numbers in the records were accurate. Now, I knew from reading the burial records that there were a lot of people who were dying, and a lot of them could not be identified since they might die. The cholera killed so quickly, often within hours of the first symptoms, that people could die somewhere and nobody would know who they were, and their bodies would be found along the road. But I knew that the priests were writing down basic descriptions of age, gender, race, when they had a body that they couldn't identify. So I thought, well, that's a pretty good indication that they're being complete. And I started to think about what other kind of evidence there might be that the priests were so overwhelmed. Most of the time, a cholera epidemic lasted about 4 weeks. from the beginning, gradual beginning to the tapering off. So I could identify when those periods were. I started looking at the baptisms and the marriages to see if maybe they postponed those because they were too busy. And once I started reading all those babies' names and looking at the ages at which men and women married, the differences between the parishes, I was just fascinated. And it became a much broader investigation of religion. And the parish records were kept a little bit differently in different places. And that is a frustration for demographic historians. But I thought that it was great because it really showed that the relationship between the priest and the parishioners was different in different places.
So how did you end up picking the parishes that you did? Because this is a book that, as you say, is about urban areas in Mexico, but it's not just Mexico City. You have several different locations.
Well, Mexico City, there are actually four cities where I spent a lot of time working on their records, four parishes. And Mexico City is essential. Sometimes Mexico City is all there is to Mexico in some books, but it's essential. So I had to have Mexico. But then I thought too that Puebla seemed to be another obvious choice because it was Mexico's second largest city. And for personal reasons, it was important. I had a friend from graduate school there who could help me with introductions and advice. I also spent some time, I had spent a lot of time in Mexico City, and I was using this as an excuse to get out of Mexico City and go some other places. So I spent some time traveling around, and I remember one August, I nearly froze in Zacatecas. It was so cold. And I said, okay, that's enough. I'm not going back there. But Oaxaca was a beautiful city, and it wasn't as touristy as it is now, but it's been discovered and is a wonderful place. They were also very, very hospitable archivists and just a wonderful food. So that was a good reason, but it was also the hometown for two of Mexico's most important 19th century presidents, Benito Juarez and Porfirio Diaz, were each of them were raised there. So that makes it a place that's important to understand. And then for the fourth city, I was in some ways just lucky. I knew that San Luis Potosí was the first major city in the interior of the country to have a cholera epidemic. But unlike the others, it wasn't, there was no bishop in San Luis Potosí in this period. This was part of the bishopric of Valladolid, which is today Morelia and Michoacán. So this was a city that was far away from its bishop. And in fact, for most of the period that I was studying, there was no bishop. So it might have been taken as a place that would have been a little more distant. It was at the time considered way up north in Mexico. But it wasn't until I'd been working on it for a while that I realized how distinctly unlike the other cities it was, both in terms of the development of modern cemeteries. But one of the other remarkable things was just how intrusive the clergy were there. They were really they encouraged marriage at younger ages, not unreasonably young, but a larger percentage of their parishioners were married when they were younger rather than older. And it wasn't until later that I found that San Luis Potosí had been the home of Francisco Estrada, one of the authors of the... I found only three memoirs from this period, and he was one of the authors. He was from San Luis Potosí. So he had some pretty good stories, too.
Well, thank you so much. So one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, since we're recording this in a time of epidemic in the United States, is do you think this book has things to teach us about what life is like in times of epidemics, or any kind of lessons that we can take from the present day?
Well, I have to say I'm overall agnostic about whether we learn anything or can learn anything from the past, in part because there are so many differences between Mexico in 1833 and where we are in 2020. They're just incredible differences. There was no germ theory, for example, in 1833. Pasteur wouldn't be doing his famous experiments for a couple of decades. And it wasn't until near the end of the 19th century that medical science figured out that the understanding of cholera that we have today as a bacterial infection. On the other hand, as a quantitative historian, one place I think I have an informed opinion is the question of how many people are dying today. It's always problematic to rely on medical professionals to come up with the cause of death. They're very stressed. They're doing the best they can, but they're inevitably going to miss some people. So when you see news about estimates of death rather than recorded deaths, believe the estimates. They're a measure of how many more people are dying unexpectedly compared to the seasons in past years when we did not have a new epidemic. I had to invent this kind of a measure for myself since many of the documents that I used did not include a cause of death. And it became clear to me that even when a cause was specified, that the records were missing many people who had probably died of cholera, but were not specifically designated as cholera victims. There were circumstances that I learned to read in the records that could tell me that somebody probably died of cholera even before. But the histories of this period always rely on a medical professional, a doctor, who can say, well, this individual is the first victim in this city. And I'm skeptical about that as well. Another consistency I can see is the uncertainty and fear during an epidemic, especially when it's a new disease. Two other members of my household work in some of the best hospitals in the country, because I live in Philadelphia and we have great hospitals here. So we had a little advanced warning about how bad this was going to be, but still the best medical advice changed from one day to the next when it came to the question of whether most people needed to wear masks, for example. And that seems to me to be a normal problem when scientists confront a disease that is new to them. And we're also living through a time when science, unfortunately, is not given the respect it deserves by many people, including powerful individuals in our own government. And so we're living through an extraordinary time that is both uncertain and stressful. So one thing that I have found helps me is a statement by Orhan Pamuk, a Turkish Nobel Prize winner for literature, who wrote, "In time, I feel less ashamed of my fear and increasingly come to see it as a perfectly sensible response. I remind of that adage about pandemics and plagues, that those who are afraid live longer." That's the end of his quote. So I worry about people who are not sufficiently afraid. I think they don't understand the gravity of the situation. And I work at reminding myself that fear is a perfectly sensible response.
Those are wise words. Yeah, that's really striking. So I'm glad that you brought in the words of a writer, because I think one of the things that's so interesting about your book is coming from someone who's is really quantitative. This book is so full of stories, and it's so full of the sort of texture and emotion and drama of everyday life. And so I just want to compliment you on combining those things very well, because from my own work, I feel like that's quite difficult to do, to get a sense of number and measure and also humanity.
Well, thank you.
So I guess that brings me to my next question, which is, what are you working on now?
Well, I have to have things to work on in order to distract myself from the present. But I have two book projects I'm working on at the moment. One is a collection of essays about Latin American history and feature films. It's a sequel to my 1997 collection based on a true story, Latin American History at the Movies. The second project is something more of a prequel to my book on cholera. I'm interested in knowing more about some of those 18th century bishops that I met while writing the cholera book. There's a tension between their religious sensibilities and the options for ways of being Catholic in this period, in the late 18th century, during the period we call the Enlightenment, that end up being cut off in the 19th century when the Catholic Church, and particularly the Catholic Church in Mexico, becomes much more conservative. So I was really intrigued to find these bishops and to see what their thinking and, you know, the contrast between them. Some of that actually was another part of what I had to do once the reviewers read the book. They said, okay, you have plenty of digressions in here, but you're telling me too much about some of this. So I could just take some of that out, and immediately I had another book, you know, started. So I'm interested in this period. I'm still interested in some questions regarding disease, particularly smallpox, and burials that were mentioned in the cholera book. But I'm technically on sabbatical now, even though I'm spending my sabbatical in my house. I'd rather be in the archives in Spain or Mexico. But I have to say, too, about your question of combining your comment about combining quantitative and qualitative sources is one of the things that I learned with my first book, is that if you have too many tables and too many numbers and tests of significance, I learned to put all of that stuff into the notes. In fact, there aren't any tables, not even in the notes. So I was hoping that I would be able to describe things well enough that I wouldn't need the tables. But I knew that if someone opens up a book with tables, most people who open a book with tables will just put it right back down again. So I was trying to avoid that. And I did everything I could to, you know, partly the title is ambiguous. And that's actually created its own sort of problems. But I wanted to write a book that people might pick up not knowing what it was about, and then say, well, this looks kind of interesting, rather than something that had a typical title that sounds academic and makes most people just want to put it down. So it wasn't successful in becoming a trade book, but at least it may be something that undergraduates can read without complaining too much.
Yeah, I think in terms of teaching undergraduates what sort of textures of life in a place they might not otherwise be able to imagine, I think it would serve as a very good teaching tool in that way. And well, I'm fascinated by your second project. I like the idea of a sort of moment of opening up in the religious world of Mexico in the 18th century, that then in some ways it sounds like maybe gets foreclosed by independence.
Yes,
Yeah. That sounds like a really great project. Well, thank you so much, Donald, for talking to us about this book. And I hope that we can do so again when your next book comes out.
I would like to. Thank you very much.